buy them and delete them, then that the value of the market value of that would just go up. So we can't pass possible. They're created each 10 minutes, so we can't get that possibility.
If you buy them but you don't delete them and you dump the market,
you can spoil the market by buying them. That's a possibility, but you can't delete them.
But given a thought, if all the legislators in the world, the amount of time spent debating about bitcoins, passing of regulations, all across the world, wouldn't you think a body, I wouldn't say anybody, would rather, you would save more money doing it this way, buying and deleting bitcoins, rather than spending time trying to attack bitcoins all over the globe? With the law.
Yeah, we don't have too much time for questions because it's the next talk now, which is Detlef Schlichter. He's going to be talking about Bitcoin as money. He's not going to be talking about Bitcoin as technology. He's not going to be talking about Bitcoin as a payment system. He's going to be talking about Bitcoin as money.
Yes, thank you very much. I should probably start my presentation by giving you a warning. I'm not an expert on Bitcoin. I'm not an expert on payment technology or any kind of technology for that matter. As you see, my presentation is on paper. I didn't even bring a laptop. I will be speaking to you as an economist and author. And I think the reason why I'm here is I recently published a book. It came out in September. And the title is Paper Money Collapse, The Folly of Elastic Money and the Coming Monetary Breakdown. And this is a book that deals with our present fiat money system. It analyzes this monetary system on a fundamental level, on a conceptual level, and draws a couple of conclusions from that. And I do think, in this book, I don't use the word Bitcoin. And to be very honest, when I handed in my final manuscript to my publisher in February of this year, I didn't even know of Bitcoin. Now, the book is really an attack, if you like, discussion with the mainstream, macroeconomics, and with the general perception, and what I believe to be fallacies about our monetary system right now, about the desirability and the sustainability of our monetary system. And I predict that this system will ultimately collapse, and we could probably already be in the end game of this monetary system. So the book deals not so much with what comes afterwards, but now that the book is out, I get a lot of questions about, how could a new monetary system develop? How would a monetary system of the future look like? And this is really how I came across Bitcoin, and I hope that what I have to say about it, this is of some interest to you. So maybe what I should do now, I should first give you a summary of my book and sort of the key conclusions and the key messages from the book. And then I will try to relate some of my findings about money and monetary systems to how Bitcoin could fit into this. And as was just announced, I will speak not about Bitcoin as a payment technology. For me, payment technology are just means by which we transfer ownership of money. Whether it's a wire transfer, a credit card, the internet payment, Bitcoin, debit cards, whatever it is. Ultimately, we're still transferring ownership of fiat money, whether it's pound sterling or US dollars, which are created under, state monopolies, fiat money systems. And if you look at our monetary system, I think most people take such a system today for granted. But if you look at it, and it was said before in previous presentations, it's a fairly young system. It's been really in its present form, only been around for 40 years. And it's really unique. It's really strange. First of all, it's not the outcome of the free market. It's not a capitalist monetary system. It's in a way, it's quite the opposite. In our monetary system, You know, money is being produced and issued under government monopoly. And, you know, this is, we know like the right to issue money is a territorial monopoly of the state, and therefore money is only really, you know, money within the legal boundaries of the state. If you cross the boundary, if you cross the border, you have to exchange one money for another. And what I like to show in my book on a conceptual level is that such a form of money is not only not the result of free markets, it is in fact inherently incompatible with a free market system. It is unstable, it must destabilize the operation of a market, and it must therefore over time lead to economic imbalances and dislocations, and it's ultimately unsustainable. You know, fiat money system have endpoints, they have endgames. They get into a position where the system checkmates itself and gets into a major crisis. And obviously the second part of my book deals with the fact that I believe, you know, we reached such a point right now. As I said, like, it's mainly my book is a discussion with a perceived consensus on money, which goes a little bit like this. I think most, you know, mainstream economists would probably argue that yes, you know, there is a risk in a paper money system because the state constantly produces more money or allows the central bank to produce constantly more money. And the central bank encourages the banking system, which is essentially controls, to constantly encourage more money. And this can ultimately lead to too much money production, which leads then to a loss of confidence of the public in the purchasing power of money, leads to hyperinflation and currency collapse, of which there are numerous examples in history. In fact, paper money systems have been tried on and off for 900 years. The first was started in China in the 12th century. All of them collapsed. There is now, I mean, they're all, sooner or later, they're all collapsed. They're all ended in failure so far. But today the mainstream would argue that this is a risk, but it doesn't have to happen because, you know, if monetary authorities don't overissue money, then maybe we can still get the benefits of elastic money, of a form of money that can constantly be expanded by the government, by the central bank, according to, you know, politically defined goals, you know, levels of unemployment, growth, the price level. And so the advantages that we hear about the system is just as I just said, we can support growth, we can deliver money of a stable purchasing power, and therefore money that is good for economic planning and economic calculation. And very importantly, most economists will today say that if the economy gets into recession or slump, we can lower interest rates, the central bank can print more money, bail out the banks, stimulate the economy, and then we get out of such a recession. So I take the opposite view, and my view is, and I think I have many eminent economists in history on my side, so I don't think I invented this, but I try to stress something that, you know, I would say two or three generations ago was perceived wisdom among economists, is that that is not the case, that the elasticity of the money supply in our fiat money system is not an advantage, it is a disadvantage, and in fact, it's the Achilles heel of that system. Now, why is that? As I show in my book on a conceptual level, if you constantly inject more money into an economy, you must constantly affect relative prices in the economy. In particular now, that money is being injected constantly via the banking industry and via the loan market, credit market, you will constantly artificially lower interest rates and disrupt the setting of interest rates. In a market economy, interest rates are essential to coordinate saving with investment, so you constantly disrupt the market's coordination between saving and investment, which leads to misallocation of capital, leads to all the problems we're facing today, ultimately, is that overextended banks, distorted asset markets. Previous speakers spoke about bubbles. These are all phenomena that we're dealing with today. None of them could be explained without a constant expansion of fiat money, which disrupts the price setting of the market. So my argument is exactly that the elasticity of money is in our present monetary system is a negative, and that even if the monetary authorities do their very best to not produce too much money, that we constantly produce money because that's the belief right now is we constantly need to create modest inflation, so they constantly inject money, that causes dislocations, the economy enjoys a brief boom, goes into recession, when the economy goes into recession, the central bank prints more money, even faster, lowers interest rates, we get out of the recession, but the recession is not allowed to cleanse the economy of the accumulated accumulate more imbalances and misallocation, and the economy gets ever more unbalanced, and ultimately we have a major crisis. So my prediction is that this monetary system that we have right now will, you know, ultimately have the same fate as all previous paper money systems. It will end in a major collapse. There will be a point at which the monetary authorities will not dare to stop printing money. And I think we're pretty close to that point now, where they are, out of sheer desperation, continue to print more and more money ever faster. Because if they didn't do this, they knew that there more states would go bankrupt, as we see in Europe. More banks would fall, you know, asset markets would correct. All of this should happen, because that's the necessary cleansing process of the free market. But it's been avoided by ever more aggressive monetary injection. And this is usually the point at which a fiat money system ultimately comes to a painful end. So as I said before, in history, all paper money systems in history ended in failure. And historically, failure meant one of two things. Either the monetary authorities realized that things were not going so well, and they voluntarily went back to some system of hard money, of commodity money, usually a gold standard or silver standard. That adjustment was painful, but they did this, and examples would be where the Ming Dynasty in the 15th century did it, and for 500 years there was no paper money in China, although the Chinese had invented it. Another example would be Britain in 1821, or the United States after the Civil War in 1879, where governments voluntarily went off paper money back to commodity money, because they realized things were not going well. The other outcome of a paper money system historically has been that this point is missed, and out of sheer, you know, sort of fear of the consequences of turning off the monetary tap, ever more money is printed ever faster. At some stage, you lose the confidence of the public, and when this happens, things can change very quickly. You end in hyperinflation, currency collapse, and the examples are numerous. I mean, in the 20th century alone, there were 29 hyperinflations, which are inflations with a minimum of 50% consumer price rise in a single month. Historic examples would be, I don't know, the French assignats after the French Revolution, or German Reichsmark in 1923. Many examples exist. And my fear right now is that we have such an end for our monetary system simply because the imbalances after 40 years of unlimited fiat money production around the world, the imbalances are now so large that it will be seen as politically unacceptable to stop printing money, allow the market to cleanse misallocated capital, and allow the corrections. Politically now, probably not acceptable. So, this is my book so far, and obviously it has a very fairly bleak outlook. So what has all of this to do with Bitcoin? Now, the question obviously is what can come after such a monetary collapse. And I would usually have in history, people go back to commodity money. And I think that is what my book does in a way. It rehabilitates gold. Gold and silver as a basis for monetary system. And I know that sometimes people ask me if that means we all have to go back to buying and selling things with gold coins, which is obviously not the case. Today, you would necessarily combine a gold standard or gold-based monetary system with a modern payment system. So you can pay on the internet, you can pay with credit cards, you can pay with all sorts of means. But the supply of money to society is essentially inelastic, because the supply of gold is inelastic. And importantly, it's outside political control. And this is why, throughout history, whenever and wherever, the trading public was absolutely free to choose which medium of exchange to use. That's why they picked gold and silver. It's essentially inelastic, and definitely over short periods of time. It's outside political control, it's apolitical money. And because it is apolitical money, it's international money. Because even in hundreds of years ago, if gold coins were money this side of the border, you could trade with people on the other side of the border as well. You know, the reason we have money is to facilitate human cooperation on markets and exchange and trading. That does not stop at political borders, it never did. As a matter of fact, in the 18th century, most of the money that circulated, the colonies in North America, the British colonies in North America, weren't British coins. It was actually Spanish silver coins. So it was international money. It's inelastic, outside political control, and it's international. And I think if you think about a global you know, a global free market system where we interact with people in China and Africa and all over the world, which is sort of our modern worldview, that would be the kind of money we need. So I think, I don't want necessarily, I don't argue for a return of a government-managed gold standard like we had between 1880 and 1914, although that would be better than what we have now. But I would argue that ultimately the state should step out of money production and leave it to the market and the trading public to come up with a medium of exchange. But my guess would be that the market would go again back to some kind of gold-based system. It's been, you know, obviously historically so well established for 2,500 years. Gold is perceived to be a monetary asset around the world, in all societies and all cultures. It has that history, and that is something that is very, you know, easy to build on. But here's why I was intrigued with Bitcoin. And my question was, you know, could Bitcoin become some sort of new form of money? Because, you know, the question is, why does it always have to be gold? Could we not think of something else? Now, it would have to be inelastic in its supply, which is the case with Bitcoin. It's even more inelastic than gold. Gold can continue to be mined, and there's still gold deposits and various ways of, you know, extracting more gold from the oceans and other techniques. Bitcoin is really the ultimate inelastic form of money. Secondly, it's certainly outside of political control, and it is therefore international money, perfectly international money. So I think that's why I found it is very intriguing. So my message to you, in a way, is your competition is not fiat money, yeah, because fiat money is on the way out. I think the next 10 years will be, we'll see a spectacular financial crisis. My outlook isn't great, but I think ultimately we're facing the end of state money. And if you look at this patchwork of local fiat monies that we have around the world now, it's a much less efficient system than what we had 100 years ago when we had the global, the international classical gold standard. Because now, as I said before, and as other speakers have said, if you cross political borders, you need to exchange paper money, and in each location, the government wants to control the issuance of money so they can control the banks and manage their economy. It is not a free market, international, you know, trading system. So I think a form like Bitcoin would be very interesting. But can Bitcoin compete with gold? That was my next question. Now, it ticks all the boxes about inelastic, non-political, and international. But how about security? And I think that's the topic that was discussed here. Now, I'm an economist, so I can't pass judgment on Bitcoin at all. I would just say that I think a lot of people who store their wealth in gold, and we already see this happening now, that the fiat money system is disintegrating. More and more people buy gold as a means to store their wealth, as an alternative to money holdings. That's why the gold price is going up, if measured in paper dollars and paper euros. But with gold, I can ask the bank to deliver to me, or whoever has the gold, and I can put it under my mattress, or can put it in the garden. I can't do that with Bitcoin. But I think here again, you may argue that Bitcoin is even a better form of money to keep it away from government. And I do think that really, if I have one advice for you, I think that, for me, is ultimately the strength of Bitcoin, if there is any. It is the ability to not get accounts frozen, to not get accounts closed. And again, I can't say if Bitcoin can deliver all it promises on that side. But what is very clear to me is, as we go through this crisis, governments will try to interfere with alternative forms of money, because, you know, they've always have. Whenever fiat money goes into crisis, the government loses control about the monetary sphere, as we are witnessing right now. They're trying to disrupt markets for alternative money. In 1933, President Roosevelt confiscated all privately held gold in the United States overnight. And it's something that the Chinese also did already in the Middle Ages, trying to disrupt the gold market. It was done during the Civil War in America, when the United States issued greenbacks, paper money, to fund the Civil War. They disrupted the gold market, and it's very well documented, because it's an alternative to the fiat money they issued. So again, for me as a money user, or someone who's trying to protect my wealth from this fiat money disaster, your gold is an alternative. And the other question is, would Bitcoin be an alternative for it also? And that's a bit of a technical question that I can't answer. But my advice would at least be to not go the route of, I saw a little bit about this in where Bitcoin exchanges, you know, go for regulated and government control. I think it loses its attractiveness.
Okay.
I think one of the, there has been among economists, and in particular among Austrian school economists and libertarians, a very interesting debate about, you know, can Bitcoin become money? And can it ultimately be accepted, not only by, you know, a fairly close-knit community of Bitcoin fans, but can it cross over and have like mass appeal? And this goes back to the questions that we as economists discuss. It's like, how can something become money? And I think one of the points you sometimes see in these discussions is that people think that, that gold has a huge advantage over Bitcoin simply because it has what people call intrinsic value. The gold has value outside its function as money. I don't think that's a valid point. So I don't think that's something that argues against Bitcoin. And the simple reason is that, you know, intrinsic value as a concept doesn't really make sense in the context of Austrian school economics or modern economics. I think when we talk about subjective value, you know, things have value because I consider it valuable or because it does something for me or interacting with other people. If you look at a paper banknote today, you know, a paper banknote is obviously has no other value, there's no intrinsic value, like there's no industrial application, there's no other application for that piece of paper. Does it have value? Of course it has value. And it has value because others in society accept it as money in exchange. That's its value for you. And as long as other people accept that as a medium of exchange, regardless of that it has no other use, it doesn't matter. It facilitates exchange, and that's why you hold it. And of course it has value. And I think, so in a sense, the idea that something only has value if it has some other industrial application, that I think is nonsense. But now we need to ask ourselves, how can we be so confident every day when we use money that it has a certain and specific value? And the reason is simply because we used it yesterday, and yesterday it had a certain value. So, you know, the base, all the prices change. They don't change too erratically, and that we, every day, we don't know what all money buys. We have a point of reference in using money. But if you go back into the history of any asset that we use as money, and go back, so, you know, the previous day, you need to come to that day when it was used as money for the very, very first time. And that is the day, obviously, when it was previously not used as money, but as something else. And that is called the regression theory, and that's why people say, you know, something that has no value as no intrinsic value or no industrial application, let me put it this way, it, you know, can ultimately not become money. You know, gold wasn't money from the beginning. It started out as something else, and then it became a medium of exchange and became money. But in that sense, it's interesting to look at a banknote and ask yourself, what is a banknote? Now, a banknote started out by being a claim on gold. So in a way, the banknote came into existence as a payment technology, as a tool that made payment in gold easier. You didn't have to carry the gold around with a banknote, and the bank would exchange the note for gold, and therefore the note was as good as gold. And this is where I see an opportunity for Bitcoin. So I'm not quite sure if it will succeed, but I think if it does succeed, I think it has to succeed by becoming something that a wide group of people uses because it makes payment easier. So now I'm coming back to payment technology. And the way it works is, you know, like the same with a banknote. Banknotes were used not as a form of money, but as a claim on money. Gold was the money. But over time, people became so used to using banknotes in exchange. They didn't even ask if there was money in the bank, or gold in the bank, to pay out all the banknotes. And there wasn't enough gold in the bank. The banks did fractional reserve banking and used the gold for something else. But in the end, it didn't matter. And over time, you couldn't even phase out the gold entirely. And because people were accepting these pieces of paper in exchange, they did function as money. And this is sort of the only chance I could see Bitcoin becoming, you know, a form of money in its own right. I mean, it needs to have a wide acceptance as payment technology, and then, in a way, start a life of its own, detached from the underlying, you know, monetary substance. I think that covers my topic. Thank you very much.
A lot of you have questions for these money people. Yeah. Well, Max Kaiser is going to come on now, and we're going to line up Simon Dixon. Then like Schlechter, Jason Chia, if you would come to the front. Max Kaiser is going to interview.
It's not the same as a dollar in a Bank of America account, which is not the same as a dollar in a Chase Bank account, which is not the same as a dollar in your hand. Because dollars in those accounts are legally owned by that institution, as we learned earlier. And you're relying on the faith of that institution to give you your withdrawal when you go ask for it. And the recent situation with MF Global has taught us that, you know, banks or your deposits at your bank may not necessarily be yours when you go to claim it.
The deposits in MF Global, you know, I think what you said in your presentation was right, Tony, which is if you disentangle the two things, so if you implement Bitcoin as an efficient means of exchange, then there's a perfectly reasonable argument to be had about whether it is the most efficient protocol for doing that. Because some people say it isn't. I mean, let's be fair about that. But nevertheless, that's entirely separate from what you call buy and hold, whether to hold it as a currency. And that's, again, entirely separate from the issue of what constitutes.